KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on this New Quarters inaugural show. I'm glad that you're listening in, and I look forward to a fun quarter of exciting guests here on Hearsay Culture. We're going to start off the quarter today with a guest who's going to bring a perspective that we have not yet focused on Hearsay Culture, except tangentially. My guest today is Zohar Afroni, who's a non-resident fellow at Stanford Center for Internet and Society. So we are both actually non-resident fellows at CIS. In the past, we've had one guest on, Danny Bretznitz from Georgia, who wrote a book called Innovation in the State, where in Dan's book, we took a look at the innovation policies of three countries, including Israel. With Zohar, we're going to continue a discussion of sorts and focus on a variety of topics, but primarily focusing on Israeli intellectual property law, and particularly Israeli copyright law. Israel has recently, within the last couple of years, focused heavily on fair use issues, and in fact, more recently enacted a fair use statute that we're going to discuss at some length here today with Zohar, and try to figure out what insights we can draw on Israeli law, and certainly its comparisons to U.S. law. So it's going to be a fairly wide-ranging discussion of a variety of issues, focusing not only on Israeli law, but also on Zohar's very interesting work dealing with some very important theoretical questions with regard to what we mean by copyright law, what its core value should be, and what should copyright law be trying to achieve. Zohar is, as I mentioned, a non-resident fellow at Stanford CIS. He frequently blogs on the CIS website, which is at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, about issues of law, technology, and IP. His legal education includes studies in Israel, the United States, and Germany, where he, and I very much appreciate it, is calling me from today. He has published extensively on topics of law and technology. His publications include book chapters and law review articles, focusing particularly on copyright and trademark law on the internet, as well as other cyber law subjects. His most recent project focused on copyright law in a digital environment. That study culminated into a PhD dissertation that he plans to have published as a book later this year. We're going to discuss that towards the end of the show. The study is titled Access Right, An Inquiry into the Problem of Digital Copyright Law, which takes a look at the relationship between copyright regulation in the digital setting and what we understand to be proprietary access control over copyrighted information in digital formats, a topic that we've discussed with a number of guests here on Hearsay Culture over the last couple of years. I also want to mention, before we begin discussion with Zohar, I certainly want to thank everyone who voted for Hearsay Culture on the ABA's Blog 100. Hearsay Culture did not win the award for the most votes under the podcast category, but I'm pleased to see the number of votes that we got, and I certainly appreciate everyone who did vote on the ABA site, and certainly, as always, I appreciate everyone listening to Hearsay Culture, so thank you for that support. With that introduction and side note, Zohar, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Zohar, I gave a somewhat extensive introduction of you, but for listeners that aren't familiar with you and your work, perhaps a little bit more detail and how you got interested in issues of intellectual property and technology.
Well, what happened is that I did a master's degree in the U.S., which somehow opened to me a wide range of issues that are generally connected to primarily a U.S. law, different aspects of patent and trademark and copyright law. And after I graduated from that master's degree, it was 2001-2002, I was quite fascinated by the brief and the depth and the interest that I had discovered in these topics, and I definitely wanted to pursue research in this area, And I was thinking what area would be most interesting, and I somehow picked up a copywriter, and I wanted to do a PhD in this area, to write a PhD dissertation. And I was looking for topics, and I started doing my research, and then I thought to myself, my God, there is so much literature on this area. There is so many books and articles and essays, and I was quite blown away by the amount of vast literature that was written on the topic. And while I was doing my research, two important decisions in the United States came down. It was late 2004. The first one was Chamberlain versus Kiley, and 2 months later came down Lexmark versus Static Control. So I'm pretty sure that corporate lawyers and students that are familiar with the area must have heard about these decisions before, but to the listeners that are not familiar with this area, I would just say that these are two very interesting decisions that were concerning the U.S. anti-circumvention laws. These are regulations that were added to the Copyright Act with the Digital Copyright Millennium, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, I'm sorry, the DMCA, which gives the right holders the right to prevent a circumvention of technological protection measures. And these two decisions were very interesting from the background, for the details, and for the really very important decisions that were rendered there. So I decided to focus my work on anti-circumvention laws in the United States, in Europe, the international developments through the WIPO treaties and the various regulations that were somehow providing the framework for such laws, and this is how I started. I thought that these laws are very interesting. They were and still very controversial, and it expanded to really looking into the nature of copyright law in the digital setting and think about the modality of access control as a possible alternative to what we have today, the exclusive rights that we see, that we read today in the Copyright Act, for example.
Your background, as I mentioned in the introduction, includes study not only in the United States, but also in Israel and Germany. And perhaps I'll ask you this broad question. Obviously, we'll get into more detail through our discussion. But given your perspective, having studied not only in Europe, but also in the Middle East and in Israel, how does that experience color your analysis at a broad level?
Well, every time I got to know a new legal system or a new regulation that came from a new legal system, I was really fascinated by the way that different perspectives to similar questions can lead to completely different results and different analysis and different ways to do things, to think about things, and to come to conclusions. But I think that for the people that were fortunate enough like me to have some experience with more than one legal system, it's a very beneficial experience, and it makes you a more critical observer of the legal system that you're somehow ending up dealing with or trying to analyze and trying to write about. And I think the comparative angle is always very enriching for the academic person and for the person that is trying to reach a deeper understanding of how the law works and what are we trying to achieve.
With that background, I think it would be interesting to kind of jump in and discuss a bit of Israeli copyright law. Now, we know, and as I mentioned in introduction, Dan Bretznitz was on the show where we discussed at length Israel's innovation economy, and certainly anyone that follows the technology world or really any other growth economy knows that Israel is one of the leading shining examples of a smaller country that has a disproportionate impact in innovation and technology generally. And perhaps without asking a question that would be so broad that it would be impossible to answer, perhaps you could give the listeners a bit of an overview of the general theoretical underpinning of Israeli copyright law, and then how that copyright law at the broadest level integrates into the business environment in Israel.
Yeah, sure. Actually, the history of copyright law in Israel is quite interesting. Before there was the state of Israel, there was in the region, there was a British mandate, which means that the British law somehow ruled had been the law of the land, and as far as the copyright law is concerned, there used to be a statute from 1911 signed by King George V of England, which was absorbed into the laws in the beginning before the establishment of the State of Israel. It was absorbed and covered the territory of what today Israel is via another enactment that was called the Copyright Ordinance of 1924. And over time, this was the law, and after the establishment of the State of Israel, the law was absorbed as is into the legal code of, it's not a legal code, but into the legal system of the State of Israel. And it remained there in its original version with very, very small amendments that I will talk about shortly. But the basic text that was passed into the laws of Israel in 1948 with the establishment of the country continued to be the central and most important enactment regulating copyright law in the Israeli law until 2007. Until the new law was passed in the parliament, and that law was very interesting. It actually survived for nearly a century with minimal amendments. One amendment was one that was supposed to comply with the Berne Convention, which added moral rights to the law, to the copyright ordinance. And the second one was amending the law in order to comply with the requirements of the TRIPS agreement. This was in 91, if I'm not mistaken. And these are two small amendments that were designed to comply with the international obligations, but the basic structure of the law, the basic rights, the basic rules, remained the same for nearly a century. And actually, the courts, Israel is a common law country. So the courts are, the high courts are having a very strong position in shaping the law. So basically, what happened is that the courts were taking this language and applying it to new situation, and by means of interpretation and gap filling, somehow the law was able to regulate the technological and otherwise the cultural environment in Israel until very recently. So to move on, in 98, there was a need felt to come up with a new original Israeli law for the country, and a committee was established, and the committee was sitting on discussing this problem for many years, and then they produced a draft, and this draft was discussed. Was discussed in various fora, and in the end, there was a copyright bill, and it took some many more years before it passed the full process in the parliament. And just about 2 years ago, less than 2 years ago, in late 2007, we have the law signed and coming into effect, I think, in May 2008, so merely half a year ago.
Zohar, when we think about the derivation of U.S. law, of course, you know, U.S. law is built upon English law with some exceptions, and of course, over the course of 200 odd years, those laws develop. And so, for example, obviously in the United States, we are not using English court decisions much in our citations, although certainly in teaching contracts and courses of that nature, you will find English cases mentioned. Israel obviously is a country, at least as a state, that is much newer, founded in 1948. How much of Israeli law today still harkens back to the era of King George, or just of the era pre-1948 to the British Mandate?
Well, it used to be very strong in the early decades, in the early years of Israel. Basically, Israel didn't have a law. It was the country broke out via a war, and all of a sudden you had a state, you had an independent state, and you had to somehow institute legal body of laws that would somehow regulate everything from commerce to criminal law, from copyright to what have you. And the transitory, I think in the early years, nearly everything that we had in Israel was British enactments and legislations that, just like the Copyright Act, were transferred, were absorbed by the law of the state of Israel as an independent state. And gradually, the state and the parliament, through the democratic process of electing a parliament was passing bills. The state of Israel was starting to generate and produce its own unique body of law that was gradually replacing the English law and the English tradition. In some areas, the grip and the influence of especially important English court decision lasted quite long. So it lasted some decades, sometimes more. Today, for the most part, let me say 99% of the area, of the legal areas, are covered by original Israeli legislation. Mm-hmm. But every now and then you see a court that is in a case of doubt, or in a case that there is a lack in the law or an uncertainty that you cannot resolve by turning to the Israeli precedent or the Israeli enactments. You see that they turn to look into the English law in this area, or sometimes the American law. So I think the Israeli judges are quite open to foreign influences, especially when they don't know what to do and they don't know where to turn to in the domestic law.
We're talking to Zohar Afroni, a non-resident fellow at Stanford Center for Internet Society here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. Zohar, just by way of some more background before we focus on the new copyright law and the fair use statute that was recently enacted, certainly in the United States, when we think about the major issues that copyright law has, or that people who focus on copyright law have had to confront, we have issues of copyright duration and the extent of fair use, and issues involving, as you mentioned, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. But all of these issues primarily touch on this intersection of technology and intellectual property law, which has been a focus of your work. In terms of comparing that experience to Israel, I would imagine that Israel is facing most of the same issues, although with different law. What are the I assume that fair use is obviously a major issue in Israel, or else you wouldn't have a committee and establish a law. But in terms of the, if you would say, two or three major issues or problems that copyright law is grappling with in Israel, what would they be today?
Well, you were interrupted a little bit. The line was not very clear, but I think that I got you right when I would repeat it, saying that you are asking for the two, three major issues in the Israeli copyright law.
Correct.
In the last few years. Is
yes,
that right?
That's correct. Thank you, Zohar.
Yeah. There was a lot of discussion concerning the work made for hire doctrine, for example, for those of the listeners that are not familiar with the doctrine, it means basically it's a doctrine that is also valid and practiced in the United States, meaning that an employer of the author of a work that is being created through the course of employment is the original right holder in the work. And in Israel, we had a similar regulation, and there was a lot of discussion concerning commissioned work. There is works made by persons that were commissioned to create them, but did not have a full and clear working relationship with the employer. And it was especially relevant in the area of television productions and movie productions in Israel, where the script writers did not have rights in the scripts that they wrote. It's quite similar to the crisis and the strike that we saw in California, I think last year, when there was a strike of script writers against some sort of a contractual, to their opinion, unfavorable contractual conditions. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a similar issue. Who owns the original rights in works that are created through the process of, for example, television productions? So actually this matter was settled in the new law. And you're quite right when you say that the problems are very similar across jurisdictions. So we have the same technology, we have the same problems, and you have different laws that are supposed to solve the problems. Another one would be the fair use that you just mentioned, the fair use defense. Until now, until recently, it used to be a case law that was the case was somehow adopted this doctrine into the domestic law, but it was not a formal doctrine that was represented in the statute. So we had, until the law came into effect, we had a kind of a version of a fair use, but it was not really clear what it meant. But fair use was definitely an issue because the Israeli law didn't have it over the years, and the judges had to somehow, especially the Supreme Court, had to draw some influences from outside in order to declare certain standards for fair use analysis.
The and as we transition discussion of fair use, and before we go to a short break, the underlying theory, if there is one, and there are more than one, but the predominant theory, of course, of United States intellectual property law is the utilitarian theory, which you know quite well, which obviously involves the trade-off in terms of the monopolistic benefits of having a particular intellectual property right for the public in creation and innovation. What is the core underlying theory of Israeli intellectual property law? Because I know, and we'll discuss shortly, that the current law in Israel does incorporate moral rights within its analysis.
That's a very good question, actually. There are, as I mentioned, the Israeli law has a lot of influences. It's absorbing a lot of different things, and it adopts what it thinks that would make sense. And somehow it happened that the Israeli law includes both fair use defense, territory fair use defense, which is definitely inspired or modeled after the American model. And at the same time, it includes certain moral rights, for example, the right of attribution, which means that everybody who is using the work must give credit to the author. It is an explicit right that is already existed before the copyright reform. And another moral right that is known as the right of integrity, which means that the work should not be changed in a way that bears some damage to the reputation and the integrity, the reputation of the author, or the integrity of the work, or things like that, which, for example, under American copyright law, are not explicitly protected. You don't have these things. This, for example, in Israel was a result of joining the Berne Convention, and Israel felt obligated to introduce these things. So what you had also in previous years, but what you have now, especially when you look at the new statute, which is a result of a really profound and integrated look over the law that we should have now after having all this experience, and you see very different influences in the law. I would say that there is definitely a strong influence of the utilitarian observation about the role of copyright law, the instrumental view of the copyright legislation as an instrument that is meant to increase the general good, the general welfare. But I also identify a lot of statements in the case law that are very much like, so to speak, a moral rights oriented. So the reputation of the author or the right of attribution has always been important if you look at the case law. So it's really hard to say. I would maybe say that they try to take the best of everything in order to create something that makes sense and something that is really fair for everybody. So if they succeed, I don't know. But
well, I'll tell you, I mean, it's certainly in the United States, historically, we've had a tendency to be somewhat myopic when it comes to looking outside the U.S. for guidance with respect to dealing with new issues. But I think as we move forward in considering and hopefully reforming intellectual property law, it would be nice to have a country that has amalgamated the best of various entities. Perhaps I could look forward to a day where we might be borrowing from the experience of Israel, as we've borrowed historically from other countries, and indeed in our inception did quite a bit of borrowing. We're talking with Zohar Afroni, non-resident fellow at Stanford Center for Internet Society here on Hearsay Culture. Now's the time in the show. It's another quarter, but some things do stay the same. And one of the things that stay the same is I will now ask you for money for KZSU. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station here at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to consider making a donation to KZSU. First, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. For those of you, and I know there are many who listen to the show by way of podcast and have never tuned in to KZSU because, sadly, the signal does not reach Europe or Asia or even, frankly, into Nevada or further east, I at least would like you to consider the fact that KZSU is the home for Hearsay Culture, and that any donation to KZSU, of course, redounds to the benefit of the program. So I do hope you consider making a donation to KZSU, and certainly appreciate those thoughts in these difficult economic times. Zohar, let's dive right into the fair use statute, and perhaps I'll ask you this question: what was, if there was a significant or major impetus behind creating a fair use statute? You kind of alluded to one, that being that the courts had to kind of figure out a way to bootstrap or create this fair use right where it didn't exist formally in the law. Maybe that was the impetus, but if not, was there a certain event or need that was perceived that required the formation of this committee and subsequently the creation of this law?
Well, as I said, the version of the fair use doctrine already existed in the case law, and the process was pretty much similar to what happened in the U.S. The fair use in the U.S. emerged as a common law doctrine attributed to Judge Story, and he somehow sketched or laid down the fair use factors more or less. And later on, the test or the standard that was developed by the courts and applied by the courts was adopted by the legislator and was inserted as a provision in the statute. And this is pretty much what happened also in Israel. The Supreme Court adopted a version of the fair use defense, and this defense was also applied by the courts. They are bound by the Supreme Court decision. And when they thought about doing a really overhaul of the copyright law, they didn't want to leave fair use outside of it. And there was a strong feeling that fair use is necessary and beneficial and useful element of a good copyright law system. And what they did, the drafters of this law, what they did is actually, when you read, and there is a copy of this, and a copy of a translation of this statute, which is unofficial, but it's quite close to being official, and you can find it on the internet. And then you see the English text of the law, and for example, when you look at section 19, which is the fair use provision, you see a striking similarity between section 19 of the Israeli Copyright Act and section 107 in the U.S. Copyright Act, with some interesting changes in the text. So it is clearly, in my opinion, and it's most of the things that I'm going to say about this provision that go beyond its black letter words are interpretation, because we don't have much experience with this provision. It hasn't been implemented, obviously, by the courts, and it hasn't been evaluated yet by any important decision. So what I'm going to say, it's for the most part the text and my assessment to the text.
Sure.
And you see that it's clearly not a fair dealing provision, which means that the list of purposes for which use might be considered fair is open. So it starts like with the sentence, fair use of work is permitted for purposes such as. Then you have basically an open list of purposes, like, for example, private study, research, criticism, review, journalistic reporting, quotations, or introduction and examination by an educational institution. So these are instances or purposes for which use might be considered fair, but this is not a closed list, but an open one. So this is this is a preamble for the provision, which later goes down to specify the four factors almost literally, as it is stated by the U.S. law, with small changes, modifications in the text. So you can see that the judges that are doing the fair use analysis, they are instructed to consider the four factors among other factors that they can bring into the analysis. So what the law says is that you should consider whether the use is fair, and you should consider these four factors at least. So the factors are the purpose and character of the use, the character of the copyright of the copyrighted work, the scope of the use, the quantitative and qualitatively relation to the work as a whole, and the impact of the use on the value of the work and its potential market, which is really, for people that are familiar with the fair use provision in the U.S., it really sounds similar, this language. But what they did do is, in the second chapter, they omitted the references that we have in the U.S. law to the commercial aspect of the use. So, according to my interpretation, I think that the Israeli fair use provision lays less weight on the question whether the use that is suspect of being infringing was done for commercial purposes or not. And just to address another interesting feature of this provision, there is a possibility, there is a delegation of power from the legislator to the executive, to the Ministry of Justice, to make a list of purposes that ex ante are considered fair, upon which people will be able to rely on. So you will have a per se uses that are declared as fair, and you won't be 100% dependent on a case-by-case interpretation of a certain court in a certain fact constellation. So this is somehow a reply to one of the really one of the most important critiques to the U.S. fair use, and this is the uncertainty of the doctrine. So you are a potential fair user, but you never know what the court would say ex post after the fact, if and when somebody sues you, bring you to court, what would be the result? So I think this was a clear attempt to somehow mitigate this danger and to allow fair users really to go through.
We're talking to Zohar Afroni, non-resident fellow at Stanford Center for Internet and Society on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. You know, in the U.S., Zohar, as you know, there are significant portions of the economy, particularly those in the content industry, who view the fair use statute as having been interpreted to go further than it should in order to protect the intellectual property rights of the authors of copyrightable material. In Israel, do you see a similar battleground emerging as a result of the creation of this fair use statute?
Well, I think that the whole topic of fair use was in Israel relatively less contagious and less controversial. I think that right holders in Israel somehow came to terms with the existence of this doctrine, and also came to terms with a decision to include it in the law. But I also think that the magnitude of the interest and battle over certain copyright provision in Israel is much less significant than as compared to the U.S. because probably because there is, I assume, less money involved, and maybe the industries in Israel, the, what we call the content industry or the movie industry, music industry, are much less powerful in Israel, much less influential. So it was relatively a smooth introduction of the fair use into the statute, and I think that it's not really controversial in the on the basics.
If there is going to be a test case that gives a definitive interpretation of the fair use statute, and this is kind of a crystal ball question, or I'm asking you to predict the future, always a difficult thing to do, what do you think it'll be? I mean, how do you see the fair use statute in Israel playing out in its initial stages in the Israeli courts?
Well, I think it's good provision. I think it gives the courts the proper tools to deal with situations where really copyright protection is not the best solution. And a fair use provision is not the only case where you have where the exclusive rights must step back and give way to use that is by the authors. So you have a fairly long list of exceptions and situations which are particularly defined and laid forth as permissive uses that do not require a prior authorization or permission by the right holder. And I think that one of the most impressive exceptions that they drafted in the new law was the exception for computer programs and the use of software and really a series of exceptions that are definitely releasing certain actors in certain situations from copyright liability that sometimes is a result of RAM copying or backups and maintenance and repair and servicing is exempted, and reverse engineering, for example, is now in Israel a statutory rule that it's part of, it's not part of the fair use. This is an interesting part. I think that in the U.S., you analyze reverse engineering and compatibility under the fair use. Mm-hmm. And in Israel, they did it separately. They included the reverse engineering exception separately and in the part that is talking about computer software and the exceptions that apply to the use of computer program that is copyrighted. So I think that a judge, not only the fair use, I think that a judge that is going to deal with difficult copyrighted issues in the future, it's gonna have a very good statute to start with, and fair use is just one aspect of it. And if you ask me whether we reached a balanced statute, it looks like a balanced statute, but under the limitations of the existing set of regulations and its questionable ability to regulate effectively the digital environment, which is my argument, that is not connected only to the Israeli statute. It relates basically to the way copyright regulation functions everywhere, and the tension between digital uses and copyright regulation in general.
Yeah, and Zohar, in our remaining 10 minutes or so that we have to discuss these issues, I would like to talk to you a bit about that. Your book, as it's currently titled, the proposal is Access Right and Inquiry into the Problem of Digital Copyright. And perhaps I'll ask you, tell me us more about that. What is the core thrust of that piece?
Well, I started looking into anti-circumvention laws, as I told in the beginning, and I wasn't happy with what I was going out there. I was sharing the concern and the worries that people express concerning anti-circumvention laws and the shift towards from a set of really limited exclusive rights to control reproduction, distribution, public performance, public display, and so on, to something that looks like more like an access control over copyrighted information. So I thought to myself, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't work together. And when I really started looking into this area seriously, I was starting to develop a different way to look at the road to the solution. And I was, in my opinion, they are not compatible. And I mean, the anti-circumvention regulations, which are telling people not to circumvent DRMs and TPMs, technological protection measures, all these prohibitions, including the prohibitions on trafficking in such technologies, tools, giving services that help people to hack their iPhones or their other computer appliances or consumer electronics, all these set of regulations that are talking about blocking access to information is not compatible with the rest of the copyright law. And this opinion, I'm not alone. And I thought maybe too about the idea of abolishing this set of rules or improving them. And then I thought about a different way to look at it, which is to design the copyright system as an access control regulation from the beginning. So you take the idea of access to digital information as the center of gravity of the regulative system, and then you start building rules around it both exclusive rights and exceptions in order to achieve a balance that is more transparent and more understandable if we speak about application of these rules to the digital setting. So I don't know, maybe I sound a little bit too abstract, but you have to tell me if I need to maybe specify a little bit.
That would be my follow-up question. How does the theoretical aspect of this study apply to today, given the fact that when we think about the access information and regulating that, of course, that's a major focus of intellectual property law. And of course, there's an enormous debate going on about how to deal with the commons and to deal with the public domain. In fact, we're going to have J.B. Boyle on the show later in this quarter discussing his new book on the public domain. How do you confront that issue in a concrete way?
Well, I was doing a thought experiment, and I was trying to sort of reinvent the copyright system from scratch. So this is not completely true, because I really, in my model that I suggest in the last chapter of my book, I really rely on many institutions, regulations, ideas, and proposals that have been emerging in the last few years. But the basic idea is to get rid of the exclusive rights that we have today and replace them with a general exclusive right that I call the access right, which has two prongs, which allows the right holders to, on the one hand, to control access conducts by implementing or deploying technological protection measures, and to control also communications of works that are under copyright. So these are the two prongs of integrated access right that might function better in the digital environment, which is more and more based on the idea of access to information, not so much on the idea of making copies, distributing them, or doing public performances. And we have all these discussions now, what is covered by the rights and what is not. So it will cover a lot, this access right, but I also propose to insert some structural limitations on the exercise and the implementation of these rights. Right, which means basically that I'm proposing that, you need to deploy some sort of access protection that would pass a certain legal standard as far as the access, the first prong is concerned of access control, and the second prong is limited by formalities. And I developed a proposal to reintroduce formalities that are concerning the restriction on communicating the work without permission. So I would, for example, adopt formalities of registration, deposit, and notice, which means that if you want to enforce your right of your exclusive right to communicate the work, you'll have to follow certain well-defined and easy-to-fulfill statutory limit conditions that would give effect to that right. So this is the one part of the model that is talking about the exclusive rights and their structural limitations. The other side of the model is talking about exceptions, both to both prongs. I don't think that I have time to go into the details, but there are certain exceptions to the first prong, a certain exception to the second prong, and two types of monitoring instruments that are designed to fine-tune the model and to adjust it to changes that are occurring over time, including also a fair access provision. So it relies on the fair access, fair use idea, but it changed a little bit the vocabulary and the concepts, and it would give people a direct and explicit, I'm talking about users now, it would give users a very clear right to access works in certain situations, although they are not write orders and they don't have permission to do that.
As is usually the case, Zohar, we have about 5 minutes left and we're in a very interesting area, but I do want to ask you this question in the remaining time that we have. When we think of the internet and technology, we think of it as allowing for greater access to information, and clearly that seems to be the case. But in your view, how does the internet and technology prevent access to information? You know, Larry Lessig wrote about code as becoming law and limiting access. What's your view? How does the internet and technology prevent access to information in a way that you're addressing in your proposed book?
Well, I think that the internet and digital technology plays a major role in the ability to even think about a model that I just described. So some theoreticians call it the theory of regulatory design. So you have platform, information platform, you have devices, and you have channels that are basically allowing persons who are sitting in control positions to filter, to moderate, to block access to information in a way that was never thinkable in the analog reality, where we were much less dependent on platforms that are so controllable. For example, streaming or internet connection or internet carriers and so forth, and all kinds of authentication sequences and DRMs and TPMs. It basically brings us to a new level of potential ability to control the way information is diffused and distributed. And I think that the legal system must be aware of it and must not reject this possibility, but embrace it. And embrace it in the sense that you first recognize the danger and recognize that the risk and opportunities that are hiding behind this major transitory phase that we're going through. And I absolutely agree that platforms, technological platforms, can dictate behavior sometimes more effectively than the law. It is now evident, of course, Lessig said it nearly 10 years ago, and we see that this is the way we're going. And the policy question is what we need to do with our laws in order to still reach and achieve our policy goals in a way that it would be effective, or at least not that ineffective as it is today.
The guest is Zohar Afroni, non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford. Zohar, without trying to pin you down, when can we hope to see that book and therefore have you back on the show to discuss it?
I'm sorry, can you please...
When do you expect at this point, roughly, to have a book that might be in print?
Hopefully next year. I'm still looking to hear from my publisher, and I will have to simplify a little bit and make it more accessible, make the text more accessible to the general public. But hopefully maybe the end of this year.
Terrific. Zohar, for the people that want to learn more about your work or read more of your writing, where can they go?
Well, I would refer them to my blog on the CIS, on the Center of Internet Society website, where I have a blog which also links to my papers, which are hosted by the SSRN website. And, this is basically the best way to follow up on my research, and I really hope that the book will be out as soon as possible, because I'm really anxious about the reactions to this book, which has not been really reviewed by so many people by now. So this is kind of one of the initial releases of my ideas here in this show.
Well, Zohar, I thank you for coming on the show and sharing your ideas in their formative stages here on Hearsay Culture. And certainly I invite you back on the show to discuss the book once it's in print. So thank you again for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Dave.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I'm looking forward to a wide range of guests coming up this quarter, some of which I've mentioned before, some of which are new. Coming up this quarter, we have guests, both authors and technologists, and people somewhere in between. Nick Carr, the author of The Big Switch, will be on, as well as Professor Ned Snow from the University of Arkansas, discussing copyright law. Andrew Luman and Wendy Seltzer discussing the Tor Project. Professor Paul Heald from the University of Georgia will also be joining us. Morel Hildebrandt, editor of a book on profiling the European citizen, will be on as well. Bob Wallace and hopefully H.K. Melton will be joining us to discuss their book, Spycraft, Technology and Espionage. Kevin Bankston from the Electronic Frontier Foundation will also be joining us to discuss EFF's work and bring us up to date. Professor Dennis Crouch from the University of Missouri, who's also the founder of the Patent Leo blog, will be on the show discussing, not surprisingly, patent law. Mark Lemley and Dan Burke, both of whom are co-authoring a book on patent law, will be on the show later in the year once their book is out and published. Professor Jamie Boyle from Duke will also be on the show discussing his new book on the public domain. Professor Michael Geist and Ron Diebert will be on the show, both separately, discussing issues involving Canadian intellectual property law. I'm very excited to have on several guests this semester, of which Zohar is one, who can bring us a perspective from outside the United States. I'm looking forward to talking to Michael and Ron. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen on KZSU FM Live from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Time on Wednesdays. You can also stream the show at kzsulive.stanford.edu, or you can get the show by way of podcast through the Center for Internet Society's podcast page in iTunes, through CIS's own webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or, of course, by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can find the schedule, all previous shows, and any other information you might want to find out about the show. As always, I also welcome your comments, suggestions, thoughts, ruminations at dave@hearsayculture.com. So I thank you for listening to this first show of the new quarter on KZSU. Hope you enjoyed it. Look forward to talking to you next week, and please stay tuned to more diverse programming here on KZSU Stanford. Have a great day.